All right, let's do the thing. All right, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another Terrence Institute for Innovative Education live stream event. We are here this afternoon with Rachel Mark. She is a professional development coordinator for the Terrence Institute for Innovative Education at the University of Vermont. She's also a researcher whose specialty is self-direction in students. So if you are just joining us, we are going to be talking about increasing student self-direction, self-direction being one of the key transferable skills here in the state of Vermont. The Tarrant Institute for Innovative Education offers professional development and professional learning for educators interested in making long-term, sustainable, student-centered change. What we're going to do is we're going to have Rachel present her material, and I would ask folks to just, if you have any questions, type them in the chat, and I will relay them to Rachel when she is available to take questions. Rachel, thank you for doing this afternoon. Thank you for joining us. Would you mind introducing yourself and telling us a little bit about who you are and what your background in education is, please?
Of course. Thank you for having me here. So my name is Rachel Mark. I have been a professional development coordinator for the Tarrant Institute for Innovative Education at the University of Vermont for 5 years now. Prior to that, I was a middle school teacher in the southern part of Vermont. I taught sixth and seventh grade, many different subjects for 16 years. I'm also a doctoral student at the University of Vermont, working towards a degree in educational leadership and policy studies. And through my work on that degree, I have been engaging in a number of different research projects related to self-direction for students in middle school, adolescent students. The way that really sort of came around to be was that in, some of you may know some of Vermont's history with personalized learning, and that in 2013, the Vermont legislature passed Act 77, which was a really ambitious series of educational reform steps. And one of the things that moved Vermont towards proficiency-based learning was to differentiate content skills from what the Vermont state calls transferable skills, and that those things are independently assessed for students. Vermont decided, like a lot of other states, to identify a series of very cross-cutting, large-scale skills that were important for all learners. One of those was self-direction. Among other transferable skills for Vermont, there was clear and effective communication, responsible and involved citizenship, informed problem solving, things that I was familiar with as an educator. I had assessed those things before. I had a large sort of background knowledge base to draw upon, but self-direction felt different to me and felt new. Fast forward a few years, and I'm working with schools on implementing assessment and teaching of self-direction. And I'm starting to see implementation and assessment that really looks different in across the, you know, different spectrums and different environments. And I get curious about what self-direction is. So that became the first sort of seed several years ago for me was, what does self-direction mean? What is the history of this concept in education? And how do we make the teaching of self-direction actionable in schools? And how do we increase self-direction for students? I'm by no means an expert, but I'm really sort of an aspiring self-direction person. I love talking about this topic, and I have done a fair amount of research around it. So I consider my knowledge to be emerging and I'm happy to share that with you here today. I'm going to go to my slides now so that I can share my screen and talk through the materials I want to share with you today. So what we're really focusing on here today is understanding student self-direction and to think about how to increase student self-direction. I'm the presenter and I am joined by my wonderful communications director who is working things behind the scenes. Our workshop code of conduct, we do not have a lot of interaction in a webinar, but I'd like to share some of these norms that, you know, this should be a safe and welcoming space for learning. With this setting here, Audrey is pre-screening questions, so I don't expect that we'll have anything that is upsetting or distracting. So thank you for being here, and we'll go forward with the content. One of the things that's most important to me as I start to share what I've learned about self-direction is for me to understand that self-direction is really very foundationally based upon the ability for a learner to have choice and selections based on their needs and interests. That is critical. So self-direction does not mean that a student follows and completes teacher directions and follows the teacher on their timeline. Self-directed learners are not by definition compliant learners. They may be. You may see those two things interacting. There are some times when self-directed learners are very uncompliant because they are showing signs that they would like more choice and would like more opportunity to self-direct their learning. So I wanted to sort of debunk that myth because sometimes I am seeing that one interpretation of self-direction is a person's ability to complete tasks on time and according to instructions that are provided by a teacher. And that's really not at all the intent of self-direction. It sometimes could completely backfire. And I hope you'll understand that by the end of this talk. Self-direction's background is in adult education. I know a fair amount about the history of adult education and the way that self-directed learning emerged from that field. You can imagine that in the sort of mid-1900s, certain educational researchers were curious about what drove adults to continue their education as an adult learner. That could be in a setting that is like, you know, night school, community college, where people who did not originally get a degree in their sort of 20s, when that might be expected, go back to get a degree. And sometimes that's been in a more informal way of adult education of just what does it look like for adults to learn on their own. One of my favorite resources and models comes from Randy Garrison and his paper in 1997 that identified these dimensions of self-directed learning. I think they're really important because they have a lot of application as we think about what's happening with self-direction in schools. So Garrison first identifies that in order for there to be self-direction, there has to be motivation. Motivation to both enter the learning and motivation to kind of sustain and stay with the task. Those are two separate things. In addition to that entry motivation and the importance of motivation, he identifies that there's two other dimensions at work. And one he calls self-monitoring, which is really the responsibility You might think of that as, taking care of what you need to take care of. And then the other is control and self-management. That to me has a lot more to do with task management, but they're really all intertwined. So you can see that the motivation is the first thing that needs to be there. And then this self-monitoring and self-management interact with one another. Those three dimensions go into self-directed learning, according to his research. When we think about self-direction in a more 2020 context, there has been a lot more that's been developed. And what we know now is that there are several different components of self-direction, and that this interrelatedness of them is really important. So something from a very, very rich resource, the BEST Self-Direction Toolkit. BEST is an acronym that stands for something like Building Essential Skills Today. I might have that wrong. That you will see their visual about how these components are interrelated. So this is from the BEST Toolkit that I just referred to. And they have several dimensions, five different dimensions of self-direction. These tend to be the five that are currently being used in the literature and the research right now. They are self-awareness, initiative and ownership, goal setting and planning, engaging and managing the learning process, and then monitoring and adapting the learning process. You can see this sort of metaphor of braided and threaded strands that when the learner is emerging in their ability to be self-directed, those things seem a little disparate and disconnected. And as the person becomes more proficient, they, sync together in a better way. But what's important about this visual is to imagine how these things are all very interrelated and depend upon one another, which in my opinion is one of the reasons self-direction is so fascinating, because it's often hard to tease these pieces apart. So just to elaborate on these five different dimensions, also called components in some cases, I think it's helpful in this visual to notice the questions that are posed at the end of each dimension. In my experience, those help a person, both student and teacher, understand the context of that dimension. Excuse me. So you can see that within the dimension of self-direction, we're really wanting the learner to be asking, what am I learning about myself as a learner? And have that self-awareness. That is very important. We want the learner to be thinking, how can I integrate my personal interests into how I approach new learning? So thinking about that, what they know about themselves and that self-awareness, and how do they integrate that into learning opportunities and situations. Within goal setting and planning, we really want the student to be asking, how can I break down a complex task and develop concrete steps to accomplish it? So how can we help students plan out steps and develop goals and establish really meaningful learning targets for themselves? We want them to be asking, what am I learning about locating resources, managing my time, and seeking help when I need it? That's about the sort of managing of the process and the learning experience. And then the monitoring and adapting that needs to happen all along, that student is really gonna, we want them to be asking themselves, am I able to see when something isn't working well, adjust my approach, and learn from my missteps? So you can see that there's a way in which self-awareness in my opinion, self-awareness informs all of these dimensions, and that in some cases, people who are wanting to increase self-direction for their students start with self-awareness because it seems so foundational. I just want to point out that that resource comes from the BEST, B-E-S-T, Self-Direction Toolkit. One of the other most common places that we're seeing resources around teaching self-direction is from the Essential Skills and Dispositions document that was published by the Center for Innovation in Education and the Educational Policy Improvement Center. They use the same five components. Their definitions are a little bit different, not at all, you know, there's no departure, but I think it's just interesting to look that these two documents that I think are the most helpful in supporting schools and teachers use the same sort of five components or five different dimensions. One of the things that really strikes me about self-direction is that it requires teachers to have an understanding of where a student's readiness is for self-direction. And so we have learned through the research that there's really a continuum of readiness for self-direction. I'm going to talk about that sort of learner scale in a little bit. But what strikes me about self-direction is that because our learners are at different levels of readiness, our teaching to each of those learners must be different. So there's no one strategy that's going to work for everyone in your class, certainly at the same time. We need, just like we differentiate all of our content for students when we are teaching, we need to differentiate our opportunities for self-direction. What I'm referring to is this stages of self-directed learning model that comes from Gerald Groh. I think I cite his work a little bit later. His work emerged in the 1990s out of higher education. He was a professor, I believe he was an adjunct professor of journalism, and he started to become really curious about the way in which his college level students were compelled to be self-directed. So he identified these four different stages. What I think is interesting about this is that he's identified what type of teaching really needs to match the learner's stage of self-direction. So if you have a stage one dependent learner, that learner at that point of, at that stage, needs someone to be authoritative and coaching. And they need to get coaching with immediate feedback. They need to get informational lecture. And that's very different than a student who's at stage four, who is self-directed. And that person needs a teacher as a consultant. That person needs to be engaging in work that looks like internships, dissertations, self-directed study group or individual group. I think that those are the, obviously, according to the way stages work, those are the two extremes. And then we have people at stage two and three. And those people also need a different type of teaching to match their learner's stage of self-direction. Groh argues that in order for the learner to advance to the self-directed stage, they need to have the type of teaching at the stage that they're at. I really enjoy this figure that Groh produced in one of his papers. that, and in this case, it's very color coded. I can see, I hope you can see that when there is a match between learner stages and teacher styles, things will kind of jibe and flow and work well. Those green areas show you the areas of complete match or near match. So for example, if I'm an interested learner at stage two and my teacher teaches with a style of facilitation or in a facilitator mode, that's a pretty near match. It's close. But there are cases where we see severe mismatch. Mismatch is in the purple, and that's not good. Severe mismatch is in the cases in the red. And what I think is so interesting about this is that I can connect back to my time teaching and think of where I saw this, you know, in a scenario. So for example, let's say that I'm the teacher and I teach like this teacher one level where I'm the expert, I'm the authority, you know, everything's in my control. I'm lecturing, I'm giving all the instructions and not allowing for students to have any sort of involvement or responsibility. If I have a self-directed learner who's at stage four in my class, that student is going to be pretty frustrated, and they're going to feel like they resent this style of teaching where the teacher's the authority. At the other end of the spectrum, we might have a learner who is very dependent. They don't know how to do some things for themselves. And if the teacher teaches at this other end of the continuum where they're a delegator and saying, "What? Go study what you want to know," or, you know, "You can learn about anything you want to learn about during the next 30 minutes. That's not a great example, but hopefully you get the idea. That dependent learner is going to be also very frustrated because they're being given freedom that they're not ready for. They're being asked to do things that they don't understand how to do. One of the interesting pieces that I have been drawn to as I've conducted research about self-direction is wondering how and, you know, if and how we give our learners equal opportunities to develop self-direction. I didn't know that there was existing research about this until I found some, but I had some hunches. And it turns out that there are some pretty major concerns around how students have equitable access to self-directed learning opportunities. There's a particular study that came out of, you can see my citation in the center of the paragraph, by Miller and Meichenbaum, which I believe that that was a study out of Europe, that found that teachers actually do some of the thinking for less self-directed children. And the children that already have high levels of self-direction received even more opportunities to practice self-direction. So the implication of this is that teachers can behave in ways that actually encourage some students to develop self-direction and discourage other students from developing as self-directed learners. So the question you've probably all been wondering is just, so how do we do it? How do we increase self-direction for all students? I think what's important to understand is what some of these things look like in the classroom. So I like this visual because, and this comes from another resource from the National Center for Improvement of Educational Assessment. It's a literature review on self-direction. And There's a lot of talk about planning in terms of developing self-direction. And so if we want to teach our students how to plan, some of the things that can happen are here in the center, you know, giving people questions to frame learning goals, engaging in something like a KWL. What do you want? What do you know? What do you want to know? What do you need to know? You know, explicit instruction about and modeling based on students' knowledge and readiness for open-ended tasks. And so while teachers are conducting those activities, we are developing the students' responsibility to be able to set goals, identify personal interests, reflect on learning needs, and develop strategies for completing a learning task. Some of the other instructional phases that we heard discussed in the dimensions of self-directed learning are around monitoring and adjusting. So again, if the goal is for students to monitor and adjust, some classroom activities might be giving very clear teacher and peer feedback, having students self-assess, using some brainstorming strategies or whiteboards to make students thinking visible, doing journaling, having some prompts to get student explanations out there. And that's so that teachers can be, modeling how people monitor learning and adjust, you know, as they move through learning tasks. We hope that as a result of that, students will be able to monitor progress, engage in self-observation and really be cognizant and critical about how their learning process is going as it's happening. We know that another instructional phase is reflecting and evaluating. I think that that's described differently in some of the other literature pieces. But again, that comes down to some of the classroom resources around assessment, reflection, showcases and presentations so that students see that there's a real, you know, utility for their work and an opportunity to share it with other people. When we earlier this year started to want to share information with our Tarrant Institute audience, my colleague Emily and I decided to make our own sort of indicators and learning scale for how we thought teaching for self-direction should look. So I'm going to share the learning scale with you here. Know that this is something that you're able to access if you want to keep the link to my slideshow or come back to this webinar video. We, Emily and I, developed this learning scale that is based upon three indicators for how teachers can develop self-direction in their learners. And the first, we think, is also the most important, and that's the environment, that the learning environment is helping develop self-direction. We describe that indicator as that teachers will create a learning environment and design learning experiences where students can practice self-awareness, take initiative, and take ownership of their learning. So there has to be an environment for self-direction where students have opportunities and self-direction is valued. That is cannot be overstated. The next two indicators build off of that. And the second is around structures and processes that you have for self-direction. So again, how is your teaching helping to provide opportunities and scaffold a process for students to set goals, make learning plans, reflect upon and monitor their progress, and adjust their strategies as needed? And the third indicator is around curriculum and instruction. And so how am I as a teacher creating learning experiences that encourage students to take initiative and ownership, locate their own resources, manage their time, and seek help when needed? So we spent so much time looking at the literature, looking at some of that information that I've shared with you already around components and dimensions of self-directed learning, and said, what would it really look like for teachers to know that they're doing it? And so we have these three indicators. We have a learning scale where in the bolded column, third from left, we describe what would be the teacher indicators that you are on the right track in developing self-direction. I share this with you because it's also a great tool for you to use as you investigate your own teaching and you think about how you might have some strengths in teaching for self-direction and you might have some areas for growth. I'm going to go back. So as we go back to the learning scale, remember that these are the three indicators. And as Emily and I taught our course this winter, this March, we very much tried to put an emphasis on the environment and the learning environment, because if there is not an environment that supports self-direction and provides opportunities for self-direction, there is no growth in self-direction. As I just said, if you wish, you can make a copy of our learning scale and self-assess your own teacher practices by, you know, making some sort of marks to see where you are. And that will help you determine where your areas of strength and your areas for growth are for teaching for self-direction. And then what do you do with it? After you have determined some growth areas, you might look for ways to improve it. And we have lots and lots of teaching strategies related to self-direction and resources in a self-directed learning toolbox. So this toolbox, again, follows our three learning indicators, learning environment, structures and processes, and curriculum. And this has so many, you can see it is overwhelming. It is 10 pages long, but we've tried to put into this document, what are the prompts that will help you understand how you can develop this? So for example, in the area of learning environment, there's a prompt about how do we talk about mistakes in my classroom? Because there's certainly an amount of risk-taking that's necessary in order for self-direction to exist and develop, which means we need to normalize mistakes and have a belief system that mistakes are part of the culture of learning. So these prompts all connect with some articles and resources around how to learn more. And you can see they cover a range of different strategies down to teacher language and teacher reflection, and how, what kind of teacher language empowers students, how you can help your students develop self-awareness and reflection skills. And then we get into some of the processes and structures like planning and reflection, goal setting and reflection, informative assessment and reflection. And yes, that's intentional that reflection is a part of each one of those, because it really has become very clear to us that an important part of developing self-direction is to have self-awareness and to practice critical reflection. And now I wanted to address a couple of particular strategies that are, you know, enjoying a lot of attention right now in at least Vermont's personalized learning environment. But I think that they're probably buzzwords around the country. I want us to consider how choice boards, hyperdocs, and playlists support self-direction. If you are familiar with these, then you don't have to watch the videos. If you're not, I would like to play these for you. I'll start just with this video because the playlists video is quite long, but it is worth it. And I encourage you to go and watch Kyle Chadburn and Andrea Grattan talk about how they use playlists in their classroom. But here's just a brief introduction to hyperdocs and choice boards, which are similar pieces.
So hyperdocs, what are hyperdocs? They're basically Google Docs or almost any of the Google tools that are out there that are created as a, not just links out to resources, but as an instructional sequence, if you will, to let the learners know what they actually need to be doing with those resources. So it's providing a frame and an instructional steps through links out to content and what students are supposed to then go ahead and do. The folks here at hyperdocs have put together in this template space, a series of design templates that are already available and ready for you to download, or we can find those that have already been populated. And like with all Google products, when the permissions are made available, you can file, make a copy, rename it, and then edit it. So this template helps learners know that they're going to engage with some resources, they're going to explore some multimedia, they move into the explanation, elaborate, and evaluate. Here's an example of one that I pulled together working with folks around the idea of blended learning. And I wanted them to know that the structure was that they would start by engaging. We'd all have an anchor experience, ask them to apply it, and then go ahead and share. So I can search for anything of the content topic I'm focused on. So doing an energy project with students. And I want to see if there's a hyperdoc out there that a teacher might have made that could be of interest to me. So again, docs, hyperdocs can be docs or slides. And I'm gonna go to this potential and kinetic energy one because I thought it was interesting. I'm gonna find here in that hyperdoc by linking on that title. And you'll see that this person who put together this sequence of instructional steps has done it in slides instead of docs, but the concept is the same. There's an instructional sequence of what both content and what students are supposed to go ahead and do when they come to this lesson plan. So that's how hyperdocs works. Want to know more? Consider joining me and my colleagues for our webinar on how to use hyperdocs and choice boards for remote and hybrid learning on November 17th. Hope to see you there.
And we do have a video recording of that workshop or webinar on our Tarrant Institute YouTube channel. So hyperdocs, choice boards, and playlists are all enjoying some notoriety right now in our educational spaces. They are great tools. They are lovely tools because they look pretty. They are assembled along a theme or a particular skill that needs to be developed. And they do allow students, in almost all cases, to progress at their own pace. So pacing is something that had really impacted by using tools like this. What I want to make sure that you know is that if we use choice boards, hyperdocs, and playlists to encourage and develop self-direction, they need to be more than just a playlist or a set of instructions. There needs to be an element of choice. So believe it or not, I have actually seen choice boards that don't have any choice. We also use the word menus sometimes, and that's a similar structure. But a choice board is more than just saying, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this, and do that at your own pace until you've, you know, mastered the information. there needs to be choice. There needs to be a place where you say, do this if you need to learn more about this, or do this if you're interested in this. So I can't overstate the importance for choice in these three different structures that are similar. And so students are making choices. They're also given the opportunity to make decisions about the content, about the learning process, based on what they know about themselves and their needs as a learner and their personal interests. So when we allow students to make decisions about their learning, either the process of learning or the content of learning, we want them to be using what they know about themselves as a learner, building that self-awareness to make their choice, which is why another kind of critical component to any of these processes or structures is that there's a reflection component for students, a place where they can practice and exercise some metacognition about how is it going? Did I make the right choice? Did the choice I made in my learning process help me understand this better, or did I make some wrong choices and now I know more about myself? So in conclusion, I'm not gonna play that one. Sorry, too many videos going at the same time. My final thoughts I want to leave you with is that I can't overemphasize the importance for us to be providing opportunities for self-direction in order for our students to demonstrate and develop self-direction. So opportunities for self-direction includes the ability for students to make choices and occasions for them to customize their learning to meet their personal needs and interests. I really think that we can start that as early as possible in our schools. I think that there are probably classrooms of kindergartners and first graders that are doing that really well. It makes me think about going into my children's kindergarten class and seeing those different centers that students can choose and go to, which is they're using self-direction to do that. So a good place for us to get a start is to think about where you are in your teaching, what your environments are, and how you can provide students with the opportunity to engage in self-direction, and how you can provide individuals the necessary scaffolding to engage in self-direction. I would love to hear more from you on any of our social media outlets. Please share what you've learned and tried with us. And thank you for listening. I have talked so much, but I hope Audrey has some questions that have come during my talk that I might be able to address now.
Thank you for that, Rachel. That is so fascinating and well-researched as a dive into self-direction. We do actually have a couple of questions if you're willing to stay on.
Of course.
First question, and this is perhaps custom to the Vermont context, but I'd like to ask you about self-direction and assessment in terms of, you know, as a transferable skill, self-direction is something we're being encouraged to assess in students. At the same time, Vermont's Act 77 legislation encourages us also to use proficiencies. Can you talk us through maybe a little bit about how you might tie those two concepts together, the idea of assessing self-direction and also creating assessment schemes around proficiency-based learning?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, Vermont does have rubrics that they developed. The Agency of Education has rubrics for different grade bands and their, you know, sort of what the criteria looks like for self-direction that students, those are supposed to be student-friendly. I know that even when teachers think something student-friendly, sometimes it's not. But those are written in I can statements, like I can locate a resource and determine whether that is a trustworthy source. That actually is that's part of the criteria of self-direction, which seems more like, you know, it kind of like bleeds into library media and technology skills too, but that's because a lot of the emphasis of self-direction is on locating resources and managing resources. So those are a great place to start, but know that the resources that I shared here from the BEST toolkit, that has very good resources also for rubrics. And I think what's hard, like a lot of things, so self-direction is this really big concept. And we, as teachers, typically give it one space on a assessment. And instead, we'd probably be better off diving deeper into the criteria and being really specific about the assessment of that particular part of self-direction. Like maybe you are great in self-awareness, but not great at monitoring and adjusting as you're in the process. I think we need to separate those things out for students so that they can see where their growth areas are and you know, take steps to do better. You know, ironically, our assessment of their self-direction should inform their self-direction in the classroom. So it's a two-way street.
Thank you. Following up with another question remaining in the Vermont context, we have a question about self-direction and flexible pathways. Are there ways that you can envision self-direction being key for learners to actually take advantage of the opportunity to pursue flexible pathways in their learning?
Absolutely. Those two things are so wedded together. And one of my early, so we really aspire to have flexible pathways for all students. I believe that aspiration starts in grade 7. In reality, there are 14-year-olds who don't know the pathway they want to take because they have not had to exercise that muscle before of knowing who they are as learners and knowing what choices they're going to make that will take them in the direction they want to go as learners. So I think that self-direction, yeah, I think that they're very intentionally paired together. If we're developing self-direction in students in, you know, primary K-5 school and then middle school 6-8, by the time we're ready for them to go out and enjoy some flexible pathways, they should have a sense of who they are and what they're interested in, what they want to do. So one of my fears is that we haven't, in some systems, we haven't introduced self-direction early enough so that by the time they arrive at the doorstep of the flexible pathway opportunities, they've lost their muscle to know what they want and where they want to go. And they're like, I kind of think about people that I know and think that there's a kid saying, why are you asking me now what I want to learn about? And so it's too late. We've missed the window, and that we needed to have been doing that all along so that by the time we've got a kid who can do, an internship off campus for credit, they're primed and ready. I hope that makes sense.
That does make sense. Thank you. Another question that came up is in terms of the popularity of project-based learning as a scaffold for authentic and meaningful learning opportunities for students. Do you see a role that self-direction can play in the PBL cycle? I'm thinking especially in terms of when you have PBL that's done in groups and you're trying to assign the various types of activities, the various responsibilities, is there a way that you can fold self-direction into that? Is there a way you can make it explicitly part of that process?
Well, yes. I think that self-direction can be reinforced in PBL environments. So project-based learning environments typically do allow students to have some amount of choice about which kind of angle they're going to follow of this topic or this theme. So there's that. There's a little bit of flexibility in terms of the task itself when there's project-based learning. If there's project-based learning that is in groups, which often it is, there is some interesting research that this Essential Skills and Dispositions document has, where it talks about what the interpersonal, I always get these mixed up. Interpersonal skills look like for self-direction, because we know when you work in a group, there's an amount of compromise and collaboration, and you can't just be like, well, I'm in charge and this is what I want to do. And so here we all go. So that's interesting, because there's an adjustment that needs to happen with self-direction when you're in a group. And that's, you know, kind of tied to collaboration. I lost my train of thought for a second, but I think, the other piece I would say about project-based learning reinforcing self-direction is the fact that project-based learning is building towards a culmination. So students should be at some point kind of, there should be some iteration that's happening, which allows them to be monitoring and adjusting. So, you know, if I'm building towards a presentation I'm going to give, I've practiced, I've made gone through some of the pre-stages so that I can see where I need to adjust and need more, you know, maybe I need more research there or something. So I think just that the aspect that project-based learning is usually, there's usually some iteration building up to this culminating event, and that takes monitoring on the student end. What I think is really interesting is that sometimes project-based learning looks, I think back to that staged model of self-direction, and sometimes I could see myself doing this, that you aren't giving sometimes enough support and scaffolding to someone who is a more dependent learner. You know, you introduce an activity and say, here's our task. We're all going to go write public service announcements for our community about a particular wellness strategy that we need. And a kid who's dependent needs a lot of support along that way. And so teachers need to see that not in a project-based learning environment, not all of them are ready to just go off and do. They need more, kind of embedded instruction to get there.
Thank you. And then one last question, if we may, and it's this. We know that there is some element of choice and agency that all really great teachers give to their students in the classroom. And as educators become more familiar with inculcating self-direction in students, what could you identify as maybe the most challenging aspect of trying to get this idea of trying to build self-direction in students. What have you perhaps experienced as a common challenge for educators trying to build this up, or the research tells us is a challenge in getting started on this process?
That's a great question. I can think of a few things. I think there's a really fine balancing act that teachers need to walk. That's where Emily and I came up with our title of our course, The Sweet Spot, which is between, them getting there on their own and you helping them get there. And so the sweet spot is this just right grain size of place where, for them to play with what they want to know about in a way that is manageable. And sometimes it's really hard to get somebody to that sweet spot of, this is my goal, right? Or this is my task that I want to do. Because if we let kids take on something that's too big in scope, they will get frustrated and fall short and maybe give up. If we let them do something too small in scope, we know that they'll kind of just finish and not know what to do. And so there's a way that teachers can kind of, in their language of coaching, can help students get to something that feels like the right size. And then that also makes me think about language. I think that one of the things that's really hard for teachers is to stay in a place of language that promotes self-direction. And so what that looks like is saying, well, what do you think you need to do next? Instead of telling somebody, or, yeah, I hear you. I wonder how you might find a way to solve that. I wonder what tools you have around you to solve that question that you have or solve that problem. And I think that takes time to use that kind of language, and it takes patience. And that sometimes even the most well-intentioned teachers go to a teacher-directed place and say, this is what you need to do. That's what you need to do. And that particular piece of research that I shared showed that when kids had less self-directed abilities, teachers were more likely to tell them, say, go do page 10. That has what you need, instead of, why don't you look through the table of contents and see if you can find the page that has what you need. So I think it's about, it's really about using language that helps kids think on their own. And then it's also helping them find the right level of Goldilocks place that it's comfortable for them to explore and learn in a self-directed way.
Thank you. That's really helpful. And I think also for our audience watching along. Speaking of which, thank you to everyone who has shown up this afternoon to hear about Rachel Mark's research into self-direction. Again, we're the Tarrant Institute for Innovative Education at the University of Vermont. We do professional learning and professional development for educators who are looking to enact meaningful, sustainable, student-centered change in their teaching. You can find out more about us at tarrantinstitute.org. Subscribe to this fine channel, subscribe to our blog at blog.tarrantinstitute.org. And thank you all for your time this afternoon. And thank you, Rachel Mark, for your time this afternoon and your generosity in sharing all of your research with us.
Thank you. I love to talk about it, so people should reach out if they want to know more.
Excellent. Excellent, excellent, excellent. Okay, we will bring this event to a close. Again, folks, if you have any additional follow-up questions or if you prefer email, you can reach us at help@tarrantinstitute.org and we'll make sure your message gets to Ms. Mark.